Hi, welcome to Powerful by Nature on RadioRegent.com. I'm Rhiannon and I'm one of your hosts today. Today we're going to be talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and LGBTQ2 spirit people. Over the past decades, between 1,000 and 4,000 Indigenous women in Canada have gone missing or have been murdered. A 2005 United Nations report found that Indigenous women in Canada are 5 times more likely to die under violent circumstances as compared with their non-Indigenous counterparts, and their murders or disappearances are less likely to be solved. Additionally, the UN reiterated what Indigenous communities have been saying for decades, that Canada's police and justice system had failed to effectively protect Indigenous women from violence, hold offenders to account, and ensure redress for victims. There are no national data sources regarding missing persons in Canada, making it difficult to track how many Indigenous women are missing, and the RCMP's 2014 report, Missing and Murdered Aboriginal Woman, a National Operation Overview, was the first time a national institution tried to track how many Indigenous women were missing and murdered. Indigenous organizations like the Native Women's Association have long worked to advocate for justice for MMIW and have collected their own data on MMIW. The Native Women Associations has tracked the cases of 585 missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls since 1969 in a database and found that nearly half of murder cases remain unsolved and only 53% of murder cases involving Aboriginal women and girls have led to charges of homicide. This is dramatically different from the national clearance rate for homicides in Canada, which was last reported as 84% by Statistics Canada.
Hi, I'm Sinead, and I'll be your second host for this show. And after years of advocacy by Indigenous communities, Justin Trudeau's federal government finally announced in 2015 the creation of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry, which was to investigate and report on the systemic causes of all forms of violence against Indigenous women and girls over a 2-year period. However, a blistering report released by the Native Women's Association has concluded that the inquiry is unlikely to achieve its mandate and discussed that quote-unquote unacceptable breakdowns in communication, transparency, and accountability on the part of the commission are, quote, effectively re-traumatizing families. Dozens of people associated with the inquiry have been fired or resigned since hearings began, including Marilyn, one of the inquiry's commissioners. In her resignation letter issued in July 2017, she said, quote, status quo colonial models of hearings doom the inquiry to fail. Today, we're going to start by having an incredible conversation with Krista from the Native Youth Sexual Health Center about the root causes of the epidemic of violence against missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit people, as well as the incredibly important work they do. Stay tuned for that while we take a quick music break.
I'm sick of you coming in here asking for my keys. You trifling. You need your own
baby,
car.
I'm just going out.
Here, take them. I'm sick of you. I'm sick of you.
Yassi, why are you bugging?
At first we started out real cool, taking me places I ain't never been. But now you're getting comfortable, ain't doing those things you did no more. You're slowly making me pay for things your money should be handling. And now you ask to use my car, drive it all day and don't fill up the tank. And you have the audacity to even come and step to me, ask to hold some money from me until you get your check next week. You're trifling,
good for nothing type of brother. Silly me, why haven't I found another? A baller, when times get hard, need someone to help me out. Instead of a scrub like you who don't know what a man's about.
Me back credit, buy me gifts with mine. And haven't paid the first
to feel, but you're steady heading to the mall. Going on shopping sprees, perpetrating to your friends that you be falling. And then use my cell phone, calling whoever that you think at home. And then when the bill comes, all of a sudden you be acting dumb. Don't know when none of these calls come on. Your mama's number's here more than once. You're trifling,
good for nothing type of brother. Silly me, why haven't I found another? A baller.
When times get hard, need someone to help me out. Instead of a scrub like you, who don't know what a man's about.
Pay her bills, she pay my telephone bills. Pay my bills, yeah. I don't think you do. So you and me are through. Pay my bills, she pay my bills.
We're back to RadioRegent.com. You are listening to Powerful by Nature. We're going to begin by interviewing Krista from Native Youth Sexual Health Network. Hi, Krista. How are you doing today?
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm great.
It's not a problem. So we're just going to start up with a few questions about your network. And so what is it that the Native Youth Sexual Health Network does?
Yeah. So the Native Youth Sexual Health Network is an intergenerational network of youth and community members who kind of organize together around issues surrounding sexual and reproductive health rights and justice. We're throughout the U.S. and Canada, so we have kind of regional teams as well as like random folks kind of throughout provinces and territories who are kind of self-organizing in their own communities on these issues. So pretty much anything related to our health, our bodies, the spaces that our bodies are in, we have like a huge kind of breadth of what we think that applies to. So even though sexual health is in our name, it's like pretty broad for us.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
So what are some of the biggest issues Indigenous youth face today?
Everybody else. No, I'm just kidding. I feel like it's this legacy that we have of really amazing ancestral strength, as well as contending with like the current day-to-day realities of like violence and stuff in our communities. And so I feel like, yeah, we could like make a huge list of like all the things that are wrong and that are, you know, violence that we're facing and all these things. But I think what Nishan tries to do is organize around our strengths, really figure out what's working for us, what do we have to go off of, and kind of move from there. So, yeah, biggest issues are like other people, I think, interfering on our sovereignty in lots of different ways, from like an individual to a systemic level. And then really like a barriers in terms of how do we work together? How do we work together as communities and as nations to organize around these issues? It's there's a lot of barriers to doing that if that's something that, you know, people have ever done before. Yeah.
Can you talk about the systemic issues that have caused the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous girls, women, and Two-Spirit people?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's many like academic responses to this around, you know, looking at the roots of violence. I think we definitely always want to kind of lay our issues at the feet of the state and at the feet of colonialism as like the main and root cause for the amount of issues that our communities are experiencing. That's really where a lot of it originates. I know it's kind of a broad answer, but it's the best one I can do. Yeah.
It's not a problem. Can you talk about the strawberry ceremony?
Yeah, so for the past 14 years, and it was actually significant this year because it's on February 14th on Valentine's Day, which we wanted to reclaim as like a day of love and a day of really showing our community members that that we're here and that we love and care about each other. And so this was the 14th year. It was a ceremony initiated by a community grandmother named Wanda. And she, you know, really saw a need for people to come together in ceremony during some really dark times where we feel pretty hopeless and pretty, like, out of control, like not able to, you know, really make a difference in terms of how do we respond to this. The magnitude, I think, of the violence is something that every time we talk about this and, you know, you both read some stats and numbers and things like that, it's really hard to contend with. It's really hard to think about, you know, thousands of people. And so that feeling of just, like, what can I do? And ceremony and prayer, according to our teachings, is like one of those things that we can always do if we don't know what else to do or we've done all of those things, right? I think there's been lots of advocacy and organizing around violence prevention as well as supporting people and all these things on a community level. I don't know if there's been much at the government level, but at the community level, there's certainly been lots of activity. There's always, whenever there's violence, there's always resistance, whether we see it or not. So that was the original intention behind that, and that's why it's a strawberry ceremony. There's lots of Anishinaabe-specific teachings, which I won't go into, around the strawberry and its significance, and doing that in February, in the middle of winter. So there's been years when those strawberries have frozen in our hands as we're talking about their teachings. So so it's been 14 years, and we do it outside of police headquarters here in Toronto specifically to make our presence known and call out kind of the impunity with which the state doesn't do anything about this violence or directly contributes to it, depending on the situation, right? So that's a little bit about it. It's looked different over the years. There's been lots of community agencies and individuals and people involved. But always conducted by our elder and always something that we really want to be, you know, a ceremony and a way for a community to come together during really, when we're not feeling super powerful in this. So, yeah.
Yeah, to bring like a sense of community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think just a way to show that, like, at the end of the day, if nothing else, like, we care about each other, even if it doesn't feel like anybody else does, or even if it feels like, you know, the kind of world's against us, that there's still that underlying foundational sense of, like, love, both from us and, like, from ancestors and people who have passed on and people who are not sure, you know, what happened to them. And I think in recent years, it's been really amazing to see the leadership of families. So people who are directly impacted by this type of violence, stepping forward and stepping up and really showing that leadership about, okay, these are some of the things that families need. I mean, every case is different. Every person and individual who we've lost is different, and their needs are going to be different. But I think it's still really great to see that happen. And so that's something that in recent years we've seen more and more of. And I think it's been really amazing to see how that strength has kind of like then has ripple effects, right? So then other people who maybe wouldn't have come forward before or were who shamed to talk about this legacy of violence in their communities mm-hmm. or in their family, you know, it's very personal. And to have this space where we can grieve and talk about our loss in a very public way, but in a public way that's not, it's not supposed to be a spectacle. We've had some issues in years with media and things like that, but the point of it is not to be a spectacle, but rather to create space where that's acceptable. It's okay. It's not weird. That's a normal to cry and be upset is like a pretty normal reaction to this level of violence. So.
Yeah, it's like a safe space.
Trying. Yeah, it's hard in a public space outside of police headquarters.
Yeah,
but we do our best. Yeah, and then we have a feast afterwards as well, which is like part of ceremony and tradition. We also need to warm people up after being standing in the cold. Exactly. Yeah. So.
That sounds like a really fun like place to have like a community and to like have support and just so like people know, because there is intergenerational abuse and violence that's just like continued on, which hasn't like been the fault of like families. Mm. And so just like knowing that there is like community and there's other people that have gone through it and are going through it, like I can imagine that's really impactful for the people that you've worked with and who've been a part of it.
This is it, exactly what you're saying. And I think in the last couple of years anyways, it's been really amazing to see children present in different ways, in terms of even just coming by for some food, or you know, kind of babe in arms kind of thing, or coming. And I know people have different, you know, ways of parenting in terms of, you know, talking to your kids about trauma and violence and all of those things. So it's looked different for everybody, but I think that's been something that's been really powerful and a really important reminder of like why we're doing it.
Yeah. That's really good. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about your involvement with the Highway of Tears initiative?
So way back in the day, and this is actually before my time, Nishan had a Highway of Hope initiative, which was part of bringing together some of the communities in northwestern BC who experienced a lot of violence in and around a main highway, which was the only thing that kind of connected a lot of their communities to some more southern urban centers where there were things like health and social services, education, things like that. We know in Ontario that youth also have to travel to get basic schooling and things like that. So what was happening is a lot of people were going missing on that highway after hitching rides. And I know that like in different, depending on how you grew up, like hitching rides either seems totally normal or like super weird and like not safe. But I think for a lot of people, that's like the only viable means of transportation. There's no public transportation in the area. You know, people are living in different kind of financial situations. And so having access to a vehicle is like not always a thing, or having money for gas, or all these things. And of course, like, those costs are not always covered and all of that stuff. So there's like a lot of complexity, and I don't want to like understate, I guess, like why that happens, right? I think it's really easy to just be like, oh, like people do unsafe things just for no reason. But like there is a reason why there was like lots of hitching happening. And like we can look at areas in Ontario as well, and like how people get around in transportation. And so there was a lot of focus for a while. I'm not getting the years right. I think in the early 2000s and in around when the United Nations was here and doing some reports and Amnesty International and other things. And they initially focused, and a lot of this work stems from organizing that was happening both in northwestern BC as well as the downtown east side in Vancouver, where some of the initial patterns that community was noticing around who was going missing, who was being murdered, the types of violence that they were experiencing, that they found that they were being targeted, not even were more vulnerable, which I think we could interrogate the language around that, but maybe that's another show, but were unduly being targeted. So other people were perceiving that these were like easy targets and that people wouldn't really care, and all that, which of course isn't always true. People do notice. I think it's just that people who notice aren't always taken seriously by authorities. So sex working communities noticed, you know, folks who were street involved were definitely noticing. And I think they started to share that information amongst each other of like, hey, like something's wrong, something's happening. We need to do something about this. And so that was where a lot of this organizing initiated. Yeah. And that was like 25, 30 years ago. You know, this is like a many, many generations of like people coming together and trying to advocate and trying to do this. And there was actually an inquiry in BC. And it was deemed a sham by a lot of family members. And there was a lot of structural issues that we see repeated in the national one. So it's a shame that they didn't kind of learn from the provincial process, but such is government initiatives. So I think we always want to like name that that's where it comes from, that there's been a lot of frontline organizing for many years that didn't get media attention, that didn't get funding, that didn't get, and all they had was each other, and they still managed to do a really beautiful memorial march. Still happens every year in Vancouver. I think they're now going into 28 years or something like that. And they actually go to places where deaths and violence have occurred in their neighborhood, and they do ceremony there, and they mark that place. And I think that's, I haven't been before, but definitely what we hear is that that's really meaningful in terms of like, this is still our home, it's still our land, even if there's concrete over it, even if there's cities, that's still Indigenous land, and so we want to take care of it.
Thank you for sharing. What do you think needs to be done by institutions to keep Indigenous women safe and ensure that they get the justice they deserve when necessary? And what systemic change needs to happen?
Oh my gosh, all of it.
Just too much needs to change.
100%. I mean, what do you think? I don't know. I feel like I don't have the answers, but I also think we come up with answers every time we're together as a community. We, like, see the solutions, right? We see that, okay, we need, you know, urban spaces to do ceremony. We need places for people to mourn and grieve and be able to do their cultural protocol when you know, tragedy happens. I think there's a lot of conversations about reform, right? So people looking into how can the police be less terrible, how can we intervene on those places. I think there's also people talking about transformation, just like throw it out, like, yeah, it hasn't been working. What can we build different systems? Like, how did we deal with this previously? But also, we didn't have this level of violence previously. So, like, how does that fit? And I think, like, all of those conversations, whether they're happening on, like, an interpersonal level or a community level or, like, an institutional level, are all really, really important to have. And so I think keep asking that question. I don't know what the answers are. I wish I did. I feel like we're more full of solutions than we are, like, problems. But we also, creating an environment where it's possible to vision those things is, like, pretty challenging when you're, like, constantly inundated with, like, injustice and racism and discrimination. It makes it really hard to, like, dream about how would we address this in a very real, like, in a real way. Like, if this happened, what would we do? And what's value, like, how does that align with our values and our cultural protocols and all these things when we're in the situation that we're in? So,
it also seems like working along, like, just, like, the oppression and the systemic violence a lot of Indigenous individuals have faced just by trying to get support and the justice they have sought, like, they haven't gotten it. So I feel like that needs to be called upon a lot, too, because, like, there are grassroots communities doing things. Like, mm-hmm. your network and, like, the people in BC who do, like, the marches and stuff, but it's, like, the government, I feel mm-hmm. like, really needs to, like, stick it, like, to what they say that they're gonna do and actually, like,
that'd be nice.
It would be ideal if the government did what they said that they would do.
Indeed. I feel like a lot of issues would get solved. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really great that, like, we see non-Indigenous people who are involved in government and kind of actually have some level of, like, power and control in these things, take responsibility, right? Like, this isn't our problem. Like, a lot of people want to say, oh, this is, like, an internal community issue. But when you look at the numbers, like, it's not. Like, it's people external to our communities coming in or being around and doing that violence. Like, that's the reality. So who's going to take responsibility for that? So I think we're really asking people to, like, come for their people and, like, be accountable to the environments that we've, you know, that have been created that allow for this kind of violence, right? So we even think interpersonally or organizationally in our lives, like, what were the environmental factors that allowed something like that to happen, right? So, and I think that's where we see, like, more points for intervention, right? So as soon as we see somebody, like, not listening to somebody or disrespecting somebody or, doing those kind of little red flag behaviors, like, that's the time to intervene. But of course, it's also a systemic issue, right? It's not just these interpersonal, like, behavior things. And I think a lot of the initial prevention plans really focused on that. So we talked about BC earlier, and one of the kind of famous terrible examples is the province put money into, like, anti-hitching billboards. And this is money that, like, could have been spent on, like, transportation, could have been spent on, like, a bajillion other things that families and communities had actually recommended, right? Like, I think this is what people forget, is that there are always solutions. There have always been, you know, people suggesting, like, here's what we think, but there's a reason why it didn't get implemented, right? And there's, like, usually because of political will, usually because of resources, like, all of these things that people say are the barriers. So it's not we don't know what the solutions are. We just, like, have to have the will to, like, actually implement them. And unfortunately, that power doesn't always lie with Indigenous people.
That sucks. Where can people find out more about the Native Youth Sexual Health Network?
We're all over the social medias. Feel free to slide into our DMs. Also, the strawberry ceremony happens every year. It's open to the community, so you're welcome to come if this is something that you feel passionate about, that you want to show up for. It's 12:30 every single year, same time. And we will be there every single year until the violence stops. Or at least that's the plan. So, yeah, that's something else. I mean, I feel like we're only the Strawberry Ceremony Committee is really, the planning committee is made up of lots of really amazing, committed individuals who couldn't be here today, but who are super fantastic and are really committed to creating that ceremonial space every year. So also, if you want to volunteer or you, you know, maybe have something to offer in terms of at making that space more accessible or whatever, if you've got cash, all those, we'll accept all of those things.
All of it.
Yeah, totally.
Well, thank you so much, Krista, for being a part of our show.
Yeah,
and I really appreciate having you on here. Yeah. So we're going to be right back. Welcome back to RadioRegent.com. You are listening to Powerful by Nature. If you are just tuning in, we just wrapped up an interview with Krista from the Native Youth Sexual Health Network, speaking about the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women of Canada. We're going to now be looking into the issue of human trafficking and the overrepresentation of Indigenous women who suffer from this crime. According to Stats Canada, between 2009 and 2014, 396 victims of police reported human trafficking, with 93% of victims being female, and 47% were between the ages of 18 and 24. Recently in Toronto, Toronto Police opened a first-of-its-kind conference with a focus on helping Indigenous women and girls from falling victim to human trafficking. RCMP Assistant Commissioner Joanne Crampton spoke to the realities of human trafficking and the specific issues Indigenous women and girls face with the issue. Crampton presented the data of known cases of human trafficking between 2005 and 2017 and stated, "I think it's a huge underreported number. We're very confident that those stats are not anywhere near what the real picture would be." She spoke to the issue of lack of accurate data, stating it's due to underreporting from the vulnerability and exploitation Indigenous women face. Human trafficking cases are broken down by gender and age, but not race. However, in a recent report by the Urban Indian Health Institute, the National Crime Information Center cited 5,712 reports of slain or missing Native American women and girls in 2016 in the United States, proving that this issue of human trafficking and missing Indigenous women and girls is not just an issue Canada faces. So why are Indigenous women and girls targeted for human trafficking? Experts and survivors of human trafficking say it is due to the unique challenges Indigenous women face. Colin Graham, Community Development Manager for the Ontario Native Women's Association, spoke on the issue at the Toronto conference, saying that women are often targeted in cities where they are often isolated from their home communities. We would like to take this time now to give out some resources to anyone listening who may need some support. Talk for Healing is a culturally grounded, fully confidential helpline for Indigenous women available in 14 languages all across Ontario. Talk for Healing provides culturally sensitive crisis counseling, advice, support, and referrals in an accepting, non-judgmental way of Aboriginal women's issues to help get on the path to personal healing. They can be reached at 1-855-554-4325, again at 1-855-554-4325, or online at talkforhealing.com.
A lot of the issues that Indigenous people face in Canada stem from colonialism and the ongoing colonial violence. Today, to end the show, we're going to end with a clip from Pam Palmader, a professor at Ryerson University, speaking about the farce Truth and Reconciliation has become in Canada because of the federal government. Thank you so much for listening today. Tune back in 2 weeks for another incredible show. And remember, if you think you may be pregnant or are a young parent, 19 years of age or under, contact Jesse Center at 416-365-1888 or at jessecenter.org. If you would like to be a guest on Powerful by Nature in the future, you can find us on Twitter at PowerfulXNature or by email at PowerfulXNature@JesseCenter.org. Thanks again.
First of all, it's peaceful. And it really represents the treaty relationship and the relationship that Indigenous peoples have always wanted to have with the settlers, one of peaceful exchange of culture and ideas and living and working together. And so the, you know, erecting a teepee is saying, if you're going to say no relationship is more important than the one with Indigenous peoples and that we have to refocus on the nation-to-nation relationship, then if you're going to have any kind of celebration of Canada, of course there has to be important ceremonial and symbolic representation of Indigenous culture there. And the fact that instead of that being welcomed, they sent in the RCMP and made arrests and set the teepee outside of the barricades really goes to show that we are nowhere near the reconciliation process that Trudeau speaks about.
Meanwhile, the I Don't Know More movement is also calling for a National Day of Action in support of Indigenous self-determination over land, territories, and resources on July 1st. You're quite involved in the movement. How prevalent is that sentiment among the Indigenous community?
I think it's very prevalent. There's a real growing sense that all of the superficial words and gestures are really overshadowing the crisis that we have in this country. You know, in addition to the fact that our lands and resources haven't been returned or the fact that our laws and jurisdictions aren't being respected, we also have the ongoing crisis of murdered and missing Indigenous women, kids in foster care, people overrepresented in prison, high rates of poverty. It's never ending. And what Indigenous people are saying is that before you start celebrating, we really need to acknowledge and address these crisis issues. And I think Idle No More and many others are setting up lots of on-the-ground resistance activities for July 1st.
Yeah. Do you think, though, we're talking about a community with very diverse viewpoints, you know? Mm-hmm. How would you describe the spectrum of sentiments from the Indigenous community?
Well, that's a really good question, because there are Indigenous groups that are going to be engaging in different celebrations on Canada Day, but many of them have said and very clarified that their celebrations are about the fact that we are still here. We have survived scalping laws, smallpox blankets, murders in residential schools, and forced sterilizations, and that we're still here, we still have our identity, and that in and of itself is something to celebrate in opposition to Canada's celebrations. And then, of course, there are others who are working hand in hand with Canadian officials to engage in regular Canada Day celebrations. So while there is a spectrum of diverse views, I think you would find that the vast majority tend to be in the group that are either celebrating their survival or resisting Canada Day in general.
So in the in a statement the Prime Minister issued on this year's National Aboriginal Day, he says, and I quote, and you referenced it because we've heard him say these kinds of things before, no relationship is more important to Canada than the relationship with Indigenous peoples. Our government is working together with Indigenous peoples to build a nation-to-nation Inuit Crown government-to-government relationship, one based on respect, partnership, and recognition of rights. So tell me, are you saying that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, are you sick and tired of hearing these kind of words?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I mean, the short answer to that is yes. So far, all we've heard is, you know, we're improving the relationship, we're building trust, we have important first steps, and we have been stuck in that mode for literally decades. And in fact, every single promise that Prime Minister Trudeau has made on the Indigenous front has been broken, and including the nation-to-nation relationship. So far, he's only talking to a handful of national Aboriginal organizations. He hasn't even started to talk to the actual nations, which are the Mi'kmaq Nation, the Cree Nation, the Haudenosaunee, and many of the others, the actual rights holders themselves. And until that dynamic changes, we're never going to move forward. And that's why there's so many people trying to change this conversation to say, at least live up to your words and stop with the superficial gestures. We're really sick of land acknowledgments. What you should be doing is actually transferring the land back to us. And these are concrete examples of what's not working.